Hello and welcome to the Hindus Parle podcast. This week, I'm your host, Jacob Koshi. The Environment Ministry has recently formalized a program called the Green Credit Program. This is a market-based approach, as currently envisioned, in which private and public sector companies, individuals, and organizations can invest in eco-friendly activities such as afforestation, water conservation, stem air pollution, and in the process obtain so-called green credits. These credits can be traded among companies and are in principle like carbon credits, though it is still early days and the extent of equivalence is unclear. Can such a scheme improve biodiversity, restore ecosystems, and contribute to conservation? Or is it just a way to smoothen compliance with environmental norms for companies? To discuss this, I have Dr. Vaibhav Chaturvedi, Fellow, Council on Energy, Environment and Water, and an expert on low-carbon economy and carbon markets research. I also have Debadatya Sinha, Senior Resident Fellow and Lead, Climate and Ecosystems Team at the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, who works in forest conservation and tracks the interplay between industry and environmental policy. Welcome to the show, Vaibhav and Debadatya. So Vaibhav, I'd like to start with you. I mean, we are discussing the Green Credit Program. So from you work closely with the environment policy related issues, what do you understand by the Green Credit Program as of how it is presented today?
Thank you, Jacob, for having me on this podcast. But I think the larger point is that we have to incentivize green action and sustainable actions. Right? We have to incentivize, right? Because we have to create a system where green actions are undertaken by many actors. Okay, that's the larger thing. Right? And you could do it in different ways. You could just, for example, have a kind of command control kind of policy, which kind of directs everybody that this is the action you have to undertake. If you don't take this, you will be penalized. That's like a command and control approach, right, for achieving the same objective. Right? But in the policy making kind of discourse, we know that the role of incentives are fundamental and very, very important, right? So, and that's an alternative. Rather than doing something which is kind of command and control, the question is, can you create an incentive architecture to deliver on the same things, right? So that is where green credits fit in. So green credits are essentially at the bottom, like the fundamental behind it is an incentive architecture, which will allow many actors, it could be individuals, it could be corporations, to actually deliver on certain objectives, whatever those objectives are. It could be water conservation, it could be, you know, like afforestation, whatever those are. But creating an incentive structure to deliver those objectives is what is the fundamental thought behind a green credit kind of system.
And Debadatya, what do you understand and what do you make from how it is presented as of now?
See, this is of course a market-based incentive mechanism, and it has 6-7 sectors, including forest, waste management, and you know, sectors as well. But how I see is that, like, you know, it matters how you are going to execute it on the ground, and whether they are, like, you know, we are aware of the ground level challenges and how, like, you know, the level of knowledge and capacity or the people who will be implementing it. So I think this green credit scheme is not a bad scheme, but this guideline, the first guideline on transition, came very recently. So it's my belief that, you know, it could have been better. Like, you know, so it is taking a very like, you know, narrow view of only trees as a only, like, you know, six sign of earning credits. It missed out on several other aspects of the ecosystem.
And so right now, afforestation is, I mean, is the first thing that they are taking on. But it says that, you know, that they have a whole lot of other things in the pipeline. There is water resource, groundwater, air pollution, you know, several other things. So, you know, just to come back to this question, now that we've raised afforestation, now the first thing that they are saying is we are going to there is incentives for restoring degraded forest land. That is the first category of land that forest that they are aiming at. Now, my question is, what I'd like to understand is, there is land that there is forests degrade for a variety of reasons. I mean, there are natural reasons, and then sometimes there are historical reasons that, you know, they have been raised for whatever reasons. Now, when you go to actively regenerate something like this, when you're trying to regenerate something, you could either interpret it as an end in itself. I mean, it is like a positive end in itself. But isn't there, aren't there consequences that it could lead to, promoting kinds of vegetation that is not exactly, you know, suitable for that thing? It can also be fairly counterproductive. So, Vaibhav, do you have, is this a matter of concern, or do you think this is a matter of just implementing it at a targeted level?
Yeah, well, I think the point is very valid, and we have to be very cognizant of this fallout, negative fallout. But this is not anything specific to the Green Credits program, right? For example, India always had this kind of plantation approach, right? Now, that could have delivered a monoculture plantation, which it did, unfortunately, in a lot of places. Or it could have delivered on the endemic forest, like mixed plants, mixed species kind of forestry, right? So it is not nothing related to green credits. It has already happened, right? So the question always is, obviously, within the green credit program also, there could be similar fallouts. So what you have to incentivize is, we have to be very clear, it cannot incentivize these monoculture plantations, right? And we have enough learning by now. I think when we started getting into this, we probably didn't have a lot of learning. Now we have reflected in the last 15, 20 years of that kind of program. We know this. So my hope is, going forward, it will not fall into the same trap. So that's one thing. Second, you also talked about incentive, right? And I just want to add on to what I earlier said. There is, of course, a clear difference between command and control and incentive, right? But what Devaditya said is very important. This is an incentive in a market-based formulation. For example, the government could also incentivize, saying, every tree you plant, I am giving to give you 100 rupees. But that's also incentive, right? Any, let's say, for solar, you could say, I am giving a capital subsidy. That is also incentive, right? So incentive could also have different architectures behind it, right? This is a market-based incentive approach, right? Which means there has to be a demand side, there has to be a supply side. There will be certain, whatever that commodity is. In carbon markets, the commodity is carbon credits. In this market, this is green credits, right? Whatever that commodity is, there have to be demand and supply. Price will be determined by the market, right? So there are some more nuances to this. Even though, as I said, it is also an incentive approach, but a very specific formulation of an incentive approach. We have to just ensure that in this approach, we don't end up leading to monoculture plantations. As I said, there is enough learning on this. This is, 20 years back, we actually were not cognizant of this at all, that this could lead to a monoculture plantation, even though it was not a market-based mechanism. Even the government-focused policies ended up in that direction. Now we have enough learning, and I hope we'll not fall into the same trap.
Yeah, but that time too, it was individual planters and farmers who took the, I mean, they were growing cash crops. I mean, that was the kind of financial incentive behind the plantation.
Yes.
What do you make of this? I mean, is there a way to properly execute this without promoting monocultures and stuff like that? Or are monocultures and, you know, wrong kind of biodiversity policies inherent in a program of these kind of, in this nature?
So, Jacob, there are two aspects of it. One is that the land where you're going to do the plantations, and one is how you are going to do the plantation. Okay. Now, I don't have any problem if land is completely barren, never a forest or whatever. But this particular guideline, the recent guideline, it specifically says, although we, as he said, that, you know, that we already know that how the plantations are taking place in India, and, you know, this problem has been there since a number of decades at least. So this guideline specifically says the states has to identify degraded forest, open forest within their jurisdiction. That means inside notified forest, reserve forest and all those things. Now, I have seen my own experience that, you know, there are like, you know, patches which are open inside a forest. Forest is not just trees and trees. We have more than 200 types of forest as per Champion said, which is referred by all the FDs and all. And if you see the forest of Central India landscape, the whole Deccan Peninsula, the Leh Ladakh, they are not like dominated by trees. They are bushes, there are many things, forests, many other aspects. So when you make these places vulnerable to plantations, what will happen? Because there's a market, right? There's an incentive and there's a huge intensive, not like small, like Campa. Campa was one of the intensive where they promoted plantation everywhere. We see disaster. Now there's a huge market, like so much money is there. People will be, including private players, including forest. In this case, the forest department is also are one of the important executors in this
thing. They will actually do the plantation.
Yes. Yeah. So, and we have seen that, how they're doing it. They clear the vegetation there. They fell the local trees and they plant big, big trees using JCBs and tractors. See, these are not just plantations by hand like we have historically done. Now, there's a very common practice of using heavy machinery JCBs to dig trenches and, it's an industrial scale plantation. So, my biggest threat is that the impact on the local biodiversity, the soil health, the regeneration, protection, any forest is soil health. And you don't have to do any big, this kind of intervention. You have to just protect the area from disturbances. You have to support the natural regeneration of the forest. And 10, 15 years, we have a good natural forest supporting biodiversity and benefit local communities. But here, one aspect is that damage to the existing forest, biodiversity, the rights of the local communities. Other is, of course, how you do the plantations, that there is enough literature. So there are two different kinds of impact.
Understood. Weber, one very interesting aspect of this is this. I mean, this is how it is envisaged right now from what I understand is you grow a tree and after 2 years, there will be an independent body called the ICFRE, Indian Council of Forests. It's an autonomous environment body. Yeah, ICFRE. They will come and do a verification process. And let's say if you have grown 1,000 trees in a particular patch, you're going to get, it will be equal to one green credit per tree. So you get 2,000 credits, whatever. And this is just after 2 years. Now, the interesting thing is somehow they are saying this may be connected to, you could connect it to voluntary carbon markets. Now, I mean, in your experience in market-based mechanisms, I mean, we are familiar with carbon offsets and stuff like that. It is a measurable quantity. You can say that, okay, this particular tree, this much time might be worth, has offset this much carbon. But, a tree which is 2 years, we don't know how it's going to pan out over some time. Can this math realistically work out? Can you actually devise a logical trading system around such a philosophy? Green credit and carbon.
Well, carbon is different, as you are also saying, right? It is very measurable. We know, it can be measured and all that. But let me also say this. It is not just about science. There is also a lot of social science behind it, right? The larger idea, so always whenever these kinds of very technical questions come in, I think it's very helpful to just take a step back and look at the larger picture. The larger picture is we want to incentivize, let's say, biodiversity conservation through forests, which are endemic in nature, local species. That's a larger idea, right? Of course, there will be measurement problems, right? How do you measure the biodiversity impact of two trees that are 200 meters apart? Of course, it is going to be very confusing, right? And that science is evolving. But let us take it that we will never be able to resolve that perfect scientific measurement. We will never be able to, right? And that is where the social science comes from. The social science part is, do we have a reasonable measurement? Imperfect but reasonable measurement. And reasonable only means, larger set of stakeholders, not just the demand and supply part, people who want to buy credits and people who are supplying, not just those two entities, but people like you and me, the larger set of stakeholders, civil society, the media, are they okay with that measurement approach? And I think the trap that we often fall in is trying to get to that perfect measurement, right? And that is always very tricky. Why do we want to do that? See, what happens is the moment we follow the pursuit of that perfect measurement is that we throw the baby out of the bathwater. And that's why it's very important for us to take a step back, look at the larger picture. We want to incentivize, right? Ideally, the government should have a lot of money. There should be no need for market mechanisms. The government can already give money for these kinds of programs. We know there is a fiscal constraint in a developing economy. So these kind of instruments where you are leveraging money from, especially the private sector, they're great, right? But we have to always be cognizant that there will be nothing like a perfect measurement. We have to be okay with whatever reasonable measurement we are getting. The other issue that you talked about is of permanence, and that's a very important concern. First issue is on measurement.
But even measurement, how can you conserve, let's say you're growing some forests for sequestering carbon. I mean, I can understand that. But let's say in some desert, some ecosystems, trees don't work. You need shrubs, for instance. Now, you can set a goal as, let's say, reviving the ecosystem of this place. but not always can you say that how many units of ecosystem revival is equal to units of carbon that is captured. I mean, extend that to groundwater recharge, extend that to air pollution. Do you think all of these criteria are commensurable? Can you equate them in any way?
No, they are not at all. And that's the biggest challenge with this market. And I've also written about it, in fact. And I think the big challenge is fungibility. That's the word I will use. Fungibility, let's say in the carbon market, there are many different kinds of projects. There is a solar project, there is a cookstove project, there is a afforestation project. The unit of, whatever each of them are saving based on whatever methodologies are, everything is saving one unit of carbon. So these are fungible. Now you could trade it on the same platform because everybody, irrespective of the source of the project, the kind of project, it is still the same unit of carbon, right? And that's where the biggest challenge for the green credit market comes in. One is a biodiversity credit. One is a water conservation credit. Forget about carbon. We are not talking about carbon at all. It has been clarified by the Bureau of Energy Efficiency in the last stakeholder discussion that carbon is going to be valued separately. And the non-carbon attributes, the green credit program only looks at the non-carbon attributes. So there is no carbon here in the discussion at all. Right? But even the non-carbon attributes, it could be, as I said, water conservation. It could be biodiversity conservation. It could be whatever the third thing. Now, these things are not related to each other at all, right? How do you, on the same platform, trade a credit which has conserved one unit of water? So it's a green credit associated with conservation of one unit of water. It could be wastewater. It could be whatever it is. And with a one unit of biodiversity. So that fungibility is not there. And that is a challenge. So you are saying there are parallel markets where it's like, the whole idea behind market is there are many suppliers and then many people demanding the same commodity. That's how you have something that is closer to a perfect market. Here, what you will end up having is five projects which are about water conservation. And on the demand side also, five people who are interested in water conservation. So they will be buying these credits. So the market will still function. But your larger point is they are definitely not fungible commodities. They're different.
So you should ideally have different kinds of green credits. The green credit for trees should be different from the green credit for water conservation.
You will end up having that because a fundamental reason why we are talking about markets in the first place. I'm just again taking a step back. We are talking about markets because it helps us achieve a goal at the lowest cost. See, I want to re-emphasize that. The whole notion behind carbon market is the lowest cost notion, right? So that's why you don't, if an industry, let's say a steel player, right? If there is no market and the steel player has to have a target, the steel player is forced to invest in green hydrogen. That makes the product very expensive for a developing economy, maybe not the most feasible thing, right? Still, you want that guy to contribute to mitigation. So you have created this market architecture. Well, overall target is still the same, but instead of the steel player investing, maybe a solar, like a power sector guy is investing. So you have more solar in the ecosystem and somebody else is paying for it, right? So same target is achieved, but the cost is distributed. That's the whole notion behind markets, right? In green credits, the cost profiles are going to be very weird because you're talking one project is about biodiversity conservation. The cost of, like, let's say afforestation is like the activities you're doing are very, very different compared to a cost of, let's say, wastewater recycling. So the costs are very different. And because the projects are also very different kinds, that part is definitely confusing how they will interact in the market. Because they are different, you know. And if you have a market that is only about wastewater credits, generally speaking, the cost will be very similar across all kinds of wastewater projects. See, the carbon markets actually deliver on cost effectiveness because the underlying variety of products is very different. One is cheaper, one is more expensive. Green hydrogen is very expensive, solar is a lot more cheaper. So the trade makes sense. That's all fundamental behind trade. If you have a wastewater market, unless there are 20 kinds of waste, you know, wastewater treatment technologies, which are very different cost profile, right? Then trade happens. But the question will be why anybody would go for a high cost wastewater treatment technology just for the sake of market. It's not going to work that way, right? Everybody will use the lowest cost technology for wastewater. So how will you actually harness this whole point of lowest cost achievement of a target, which is the fundamental behind any market architecture? That is definitely, we need to have a lot more understanding. As a market, it will still work, you know. It will still work only in the way that finance will flow. So Infosys will say, I'm interested in biodiversity conservation. These are five biodiversity conservation projects. The GOI has issued green credits. I want to buy it, right? Which is fine. the cost which I want to buy might be very expensive because biodiversity conservation is a lot more expensive than wastewater treatment or other way around, whatever it is, right? But Infosys will buy, give some cost plus markup. It is not truly the market price fluctuations that are happening in a carbon market style. Right? So there are differences in all of these kinds of things and nuances.
What do you say, Debadatyo? Can you have this one green credit and automatically have companies on their own incentivized enough to participate in it? And do you see this problem of different kinds of structures, different activities being incentivized differently?
See, there are many aspects to it. One important aspect is that, this green credit, how they're playing with this mandatory compliances. For example, in the case of forest clearances, the guideline clearly says the green credits earned from these plantations can be used while applying for forest clearance. Okay. So, again, the problem is that can you separate forest, water, biodiversity, livelihood separately? Okay. And can you uniformize them? Every place is different, unique. Okay. So there is a problem, and I think this is going with the assumption that we are not going to compromise on our industrial growth, economic growth. That is something which is primary. And all these things will be taken care of, and the industry should not be threatened that, this law is there. So basically, it is more of ease of doing business, because the moment you are breaking this precautionary principle, like as Vaibhav said, that you cannot measure, beyond seeing. But at least you can have proportionate kind of compensation, okay? So this proportionality has to be there in any environmental law. The fundamental principle is there. So when you were taking a very myopic view of only just tree crowned as a green credit and you can, when applying forest clearance, there's so many aspects. But you can take the green credit and value apply. So you are avoiding all those site-specific, So and we have to see how it plays out, because the guideline clearly enables this kind of use of green credit. So it's not just incentivizing, it also helping the industries getting quick clearances, forest clearances and all.
To build on that, do you think the way this is structured in a legal sense right now, does it clash with any of our other environmental laws in any way? Do you see clashes?
Definitely, especially at least in this guideline, you can see clearly the clashes between the Forest Conservation Act. The way they have, there's no definition of forest, there's no definition of degraded forest. Okay. So, and we will end up identifying open natural ecosystems as forest. And also it is bypassing the whole forest clearance process just to help the industries getting green credit. And while applying, you say, I have already green credit, you give me the clearance quickly. Otherwise, you have stage one, stage two, you have to apply stage one to the state. State will certify, you have submitted the amount, the land is identified. Then you get the stage two. There's a long process. And it is ideal because, this is when things are so complicated, you have to take a very nuanced approach and you have to follow all the principles of environmental law, which already is compromised in our country. So we should take the steps to strengthen it. It cannot be excused that because it hasn't worked, so we'll not do it. The ideal, the state, the center, the government should be working towards strengthening these laws and protecting the biodiversity, forests, and everything. And the law should not be relaxing those safeguards. So I see clearly this is although there are some incentive also there, but it is helping the industries getting quick clearances and all these things are there.
Great, thanks. Vaibhav, we know there is emission trading schemes for carbon and all that in many parts of the world. Are you familiar with this practice where where you have a trading scheme in non-carbon based approaches anywhere else in the world, or is this like a completely unique Indian creation?
Yeah, well, non-carbon SO2, we know the acid rain was actually stopped with the help of sulfur dioxide trading, right? That was like the first big win of the market instruments in the US, right, when it started. Of course, carbon, we know carbon is the biggest one, so we know. Well, non-SO2, non-carbon, I think some things like biodiversity credits, we have seen some discussions happening. I'm not aware of like a big program, anything like that, but it's not an India-specific discussion.
Even HFCs and SO2, at the end of it, you could imagine them like carbon. You have to reduce a certain fixed product.
Exactly.
But this is a little different, right, as we've been
discussing. This is definitely different. Say, all of those still can be measured. You can measure sulfur dioxide. know, it could be measured. Here, the biggest challenge is definitely measurement. But as I said, you cannot have the perfect measurement. We should stop thinking about a perfect measurement if we are thinking in this particular domain. So that's the quick answer. Also, just want to add on to what Devaditya earlier said. I think this challenge of that green credit being used for getting clearances. I mean, some things were already there. Like that's exactly what compensatory afforestation was in some ways. It was exactly that, right? That you will be clearing a patch of forest in one area and you could compensate in some other area. So there is the same clash there, right? That thing that you want to clear might be a biodiversity hotspot, right? And you can just plant trees in some other location and get away with it. Or you could provide funds and say somewhere the state government can decide where it wants to do the compensation, so to speak. So in that sense, this kind of thing, of course, is a new instrument, you could say. It's a new way.
Yeah, but in fact, the problem ended up being that, companies said that companies were told that you have to pay the value of the forest you destroyed, plus you have to give us some compensatory land somewhere else where we can renew the forest somewhere. It should either be revenue land or it should be twice the amount of degraded forest. Now, the issue is apparently land is not available. Land is the biggest crisis anywhere. So,
of course. But let me also say this. We are focusing a lot on the forest, which is a lot more challenging. I do know. But Green Credit Program is not just about forest. I mean, and there are a lot of civil society watching this whole discourse. So, it's not that all these, like the challenges with CAMPA or this compensatory afforestation has not been highlighted. There's not been pushback. There's not been a conversation with the government. All those things have happened. So I'm sure these very important points that Devaditya are highlighting also will be discussed. Right? It cannot be so easy that you just buy credits and you continue with the destruction of a biodiversity hotspot. It's not going to be
a
problem.
From a company's perspective, I mean, till now, you can always, all our CSR activity essentially is this planting trees and, you can do certain of these acts like this. And they advertise it in their annual reports. I'm sure people get all kinds of green kind stamps and which they tell their shareholders and all that. All of these activities you can still do. Why would any company want to do this? I mean, what is, from a purely very market oriented approach, why would anybody want to be part of this? I mean, unless you're forced.
Part of the green trade program.
Green trade program. Yeah.
It's the same thing for carbon also, right? Why would any company in the voluntary market be part of the demand side of the carbon? Why does Infosys buy carbon credits from the voluntary market? Right? Because climate is an issue, so I want to reduce. So carbon credits is an instrument for that. So I will do that. Same here. If you think wastewater recycling is very important for the economy. I want to, carbon market is an instrument which is worked for climate financing, right? Be it international one or be it domestic from one party to other, it is an instrument where finance flows from one party to other. The question is, what is the underlying activity? Is that activity, is it convincing enough for the buyer of the credit, right? That I want to support wastewater recycling in India, I want to take it to the next level, because water is a challenge, right? I want to ensure biodiversity conservation, I want to ensure any third thing. Right, so it's that kind of thing. That's where the demand comes from. It is entirely voluntary as of now in nature, unless some compliance comes in, which I don't know what shape of the compliance will be.
So yeah. You think it is altruism that would still drive a company to partake in this?
Yeah,
any credits, it can't be. It doesn't have to be altruism. I mean, it has to be
as of now
from compliance.
No, it doesn't come from voluntary market. Is nothing related to compliance. Any activity happening in the voluntary market. Yeah. So of course, compliance is, there's no notion of altruism in compliance, it's compliance, you have to comply, altruism is kind of exhibited only when you're participating in a voluntary activity. So you could say it is, of course, we don't know the real reason, but you could argue that, it act in some way exhibits this kind of, altruistic behavior. It could also be that you want, your shareholders, for example, it could be altruistic in Indian context. In Norwegian context, there will be nothing altruistic about it, in the sense that your shareholders are demanding it. Like, there is a big push. So as a manager of a company, you might not care about the environment, but the ecosystem is such that it will push you towards these kinds of things, right? So these contexts are very different, and the way decision makers will and company level decision makers will act is different. But in Indian context, when there is no such larger ecosystem which is pushing you towards this thing, one will very well argue that it is only the corporate social responsibility or altruistic motives because of which I want to conserve, like I want to invest in wastewater recycling through green credit. I want to conserve biodiversity through green credits, you know, that one could always argue.
So, Debatir, do you think altruism will drive company, Indian companies to, you know, to participate in this program, or do you see them as actively, do you think that this will benefit them? I mean, you alluded to something in your earlier answer regarding easing compliances, but what about the role of altruism?
Well, Jacob, to be very practical, tell me which company will be willing to sacrifice the profit, because they are working for profit, right? Maybe exception, one or two company exception, but no one going willing to see the level of environmental compliances. When we have so poor enforcement, like compliances by the companies for environmental laws, and to expect them to be voluntarily taking part actively in this kind of mechanism without any benefit, I think it is just I don't buy that argument as much. To be very practical, but of course there are some companies who will be willing to showcase their ESG reports and everything, and some can brand them as well, products. But largely, if you ask me, the situation, I don't know about a country, but in India we have seen no one wants to compromise with their profit making.
Yeah, but that's a very different frame. Altruism versus altruism at the cost of profits, right? I don't think anybody, even in developed world, why India? Which company, does Shell does carbon market because of altruistic? Nobody will do that. That's not even we should expect, right? I am simply saying they will frame it in that way, that it is my social responsibility. Whether we are convinced or not is a separate question. Maybe all of us are not convinced. And that's why there are limits to this whole altruistic behavior. Limits in the sense, every company will buy carbon credits only if it is not very expensive. Right, so those can be, you know, there are limits to it, and that's why compliance has a tremendous role, especially let's say in carbon market or anything, because beyond a point, companies will actually not drive. I don't believe in this whole notion of voluntary behavior. To some extent, I know it will be there. We know that it will be totally about brand building and many other things. They will like to frame it in an altruistic way, in a social responsibility way. I think more often than not, it will be about brand building and all that rather than anything else. And beyond a point, that will also stop. Beyond a point, only compliance will actually deliver on anything, be it carbon, be it biodiversity conservation, only compliance. So policy has a tremendously important role to play in this whole larger debate in the backdrop of, and that's why compliance carbon markets in the long run are going to deliver on net zero, not voluntary carbon markets.
So in closing, to sum up our discussion, so I'll, Vaibhav, do you think the way the policy is framed now in this manner just needs to be unleashed and will work, or do you think it needs some major tweaks for it to get benefits? You can start, Vaibhav, some, and then Debatir, you can come.
See, I have my own biases. I'm an economist, and that too an economist on the the right of the economics. So I'm fundamentally biased towards market-based approaches. I think they're tremendous. There's tremendous evidence, which is great. At the same time, I think all of us, including me, should be cognizant and know that there always have to be guardrails. There's nothing like perfect market. There always has to be a role of regulation, and there has to be guardrails. In the case, the green credits are within the afforestation domain, we know the guardrails. That you cannot destroy a biodiversity hotspot and just do compensation and just buy green credits, right? Not at all. There have to be guardrails. So that notion of guardrails is very, very important. But but as a fundamental instrument, market-based instruments are tremendous. They've already demonstrated so much of success around the world. So that instrument is great. But of course, we have to always have these guardrails on.
Debatir, your closing thoughts on this?
Yeah, we just extend what WebHub's EU is. So one thing is that there has to be safeguards, especially with regards to the concerns about this grassland, scrub forest, and the natural forest. Those safeguards has to be there. So unfortunately, this guideline on plantations is opening up everything. So I think this loophole needs to be plugged. And there has to be facilitation of the natural forestation. It's not just planting trees, big trees, which is the last in the forest ecosystem. There should be approach for soil conservation. Soils are the basic of any forest in terms of everything. So now this holistic approach has to be there in terms of restoration. It should be more about ecological restoration rather than a plantation. We are confusing plantation with afforestation. I think this is where we need to clearly draw the boundaries. Like, you know, and this policy has to be very clear to safeguard the natural ecosystem and other things. So I think this is my views.
Great. Great. Thanks a lot, Vaibhav and Debatio. Thanks a lot for taking time out and being part of this.